Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did Zelda and Scott Fitzgerald spend their final days together? Literary historians know the pair spent their last week as a couple on vacation to Cuba in the spring of 1939, when Scott was struggling mightily to earn a living as a Hollywood screenwriter and Zelda was on temporary leave from a mental institution. But they don't have a lot of details about what took place on the trip itself, or why, despite talk of reuniting again, the most famous couple of the jazz age were never in one another's presence before Scott's death a year and a half later. That lost week turned out to be fertile ground for novelist R. Clifton Spargo, who used history as a framework around which to create a fascinating fictional account of the Fitzgeralds' final rendezvous. The new book is called Beautiful Fools, The Last Affair of Zelda and Scott Fitzgerald. Clifton Spargo is in town to speak this evening at the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture, and we are delighted he could make time for us this afternoon. Clifton, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me.
We should start this by noting that today is actually F. Scott Fitzgerald's birthday.
Perfectly timed.
Perfectly timed. It's wonderful to have you here for that. You could have chosen any number of moments in the Fitzgeralds' lives together to explore in this way. What drew you to this one?
I feel like the moment chose me on some level. The appeal of that scenario, I would say that I was a longtime Fitzgerald aficionado. Scott was really one of my first loves as a writer. This Side of Paradise I read very young. James Joyce's Dubliners, those are probably the two books that made me want to be a writer. Mm-hmm. So I knew his work very well, and I knew the biographies. And over time, I became more and more fascinated with Zelda herself. And then as you become immersed in the lore, and this is these are two people whose lives are incredibly well documented, and they documented their lives themselves. Scott kept a ledger from the time he was like 10. And yet you get to this final moment, and the biographers have very little to say because very little is known. And I always find myself flipping back through whatever biography saying, I would find myself flipping back saying, wait, when did they last see each other? And it was the idea of this trip that is this hole in history. And at the same time, it's the last chance for Scott and Zelda, but they don't know it. And for me, that scenario became what grabbed me and pulled me in, and it was the story I wanted to tell.
So give us a basic outline of the historical details that you did have about the trip.
Well, the historical details are thin, and there are a few clues from biographers. I took a few of them to heart, and others I think I had liberty to play with. There's a few things that I found out. I didn't find any of the biographies actually citing when they arrived and when they departed, but I was able to establish the exact length of the trip by flipping through old copies of the Havana Post, which was an English daily published in Cuba at the time. So they arrived April 14th and departed April 22nd. That's that's not said directly in the novel, but I happen to know that. And if you do the timing of the novel, it does work out to exactly 8 days. Then there are a few other little clues. We do know the frame of how it ends, and we know that it ends really post my novel with Zelda's checking Scott into a hospital in New York and having to get back to Asheville to her asylum on her own. And we have the letters that she wrote both before she returns, a couple notes she leaves with Scott, and then some notes she sends from the asylum. And that's mostly our framework. There are a few other little clues in the biographies. Nancy Milford had some evidence of a cockfight, and I thought, well, okay, that's going in my novel. So there's a lot of research that went into making a realistic cockfight by the end of the novel. But the frame is very, very loose, and there are certain things that I took liberties with. If the interesting thing about the trip, of course, is we know Cuba belongs to Hemingway. Mm-hmm. We don't think of Fitzgerald's in Cuba. So Cuba belongs to Hemingway, and not only does it belong to Hemingway, it belongs to Hemingway right at this moment. He's just finishing For Whom the Bell Tolls in the Hotel Ambus Mundus. If Scott and Ernest had met, we would know that their last meeting was a year or two before this. But I could not resist putting Scott in the hotel where Ernest stayed. And there's no actual evidence for that, but there are all kinds of reasons that evoke certain kinds of possibilities. Scott longing to be reunited, but also dreading to be reunited with his old friend. So certain choices like that were novelistic choices. And just as a little footnote there, John Dos Passos, another famous writer from the time, friends with both Scott and Ernest, had written Scott a note, which is in the Princeton archive, on stationery from the Hotel Ambos Mundus a year or two before this. So I thought it was plausible that he could stay there. And I, as a novelist, wanted him to stay there.
Well, you know, it's interesting that Hemingway hovers sort of like a ghost over the whole story, because this is a time in which Fitzgerald is still wrestling with, and I guess never satisfactorily wrestled with, the idea that his moment has come and gone.
Yeah. Well, in fairness to Scott, I think that's a little hard. I think that's how he was treated. I actually think he just wrote his best novel a few years ago. I'm of the school that thinks Tender as the Night is the best finished Scott novel. Actually, I love The Gatsby, but I think Tender as the Night is even better. And I think the one he was working on when he died, The Last Tycoon, might have trumped them all. So I don't think Scott had lost his mojo. He had lost a lot of his audience, and he felt that profoundly. And he suffered immense depression in the middle of the 30s, which he chronicled in very groundbreaking material at the time. Hemingway and Dos Passos, actually, are two of the people who scolded him for this. He wrote a series of very confessional essays for Esquire, which we now call The Crack-Up. It's very forward-looking. It's that confessional, memoiristic essay. There wasn't a lot of that kind of material at the time. But that's powerful writing for the middle of the 30s as well. He had Arnold Gingrich at Esquire was devoted to Scott and said, just write anything for me and I'll pay you. And so Scott wrote those essays. And then he goes to Hollywood and he actually really takes that job. For a long time, he had two former trips to Hollywood. Neither met with great success. But he takes this new journey in Hollywood very seriously. And he writes some very fine scripts, only one that he ended up getting a screen credit for, which did win an award, Three Comrades. But he worked briefly on Gone with the Wind.
He's very bitter that he didn't get his due for that.
Well, in my novel, he is, at least. He's bitter because Zelda brings it up as though he had worked on it. Mm-hmm. And I think what he was bitter about is, and some of the correspondence suggests this, is he started to have more and more of a restricted role in what he could do. Mm-hmm. He thought he would be able to write these truly original movie scripts, and he worked very hard. And the best one, most critics, I think, agree on this, and I am with the consensus here. He was working on a film that was originally to be titled Infidelity, then was retitled Fidelity because already they were afraid of the censors. Hmm. It was to star Joan Crawford, and it's really quite a powerful script. He thought it was going to be the Madame Bovary of Hollywood, but they got afraid of the censors. They thought it was too daring. It involved a plot of adultery without someone being awfully punished by the end, and that was taboo for Hollywood at the time. So he took that art very seriously, and that informs, if nothing else, it would have been nice if he could have had a few more screen successes, but informs the tremendous book he was working on at the very end, The Last Tycoon, which still, even though it's a partial novel, maybe besides Nathaniel West's Day of the Locust, still rates for me as the best Hollywood novel, even though it's incomplete.
You know, it's interesting, Clifton, when you say he took his Hollywood work very seriously. And in this novel, you have him going through, because he knows that he'll be writing for Joan Crawford, looking at all of her films, yeah, really evaluating her acting. Is there evidence from the history that this is something he did?
Yes, there is evidence that he took that very seriously. He would watch actresses. The Joan Crawford bit is largely fictionalized, though there's a brief note that he wrote to Gerald Murphy. And for general listeners, Gerald and Sarah Murphy may ring a bell. Those were the famous.
Actually, an exhibition at the Dallas Museum of Art of some of their collections. So many Dallasites and Fort Worthers may know.
Marvelous, right? They were the expatriate friends of Scott and Zelda who really made the Riviera what it is. I mean, they made it place that Americans and some Europeans went. And Murphy himself was a very experimental painter and influenced by a lot of the greats of his time, New Picasso and those folks. And Scott writes a snide little remark to Murphy about Joan Crawford's acting, and that's what I base that whole bit in my novel on. It's just that clue. But he did make a close study. He took the art very seriously. He believed cinema was very powerful. Early in his career, he would sometimes write his editor and say, if I do 3 more Saturday Evening Post stories and we publish this short story collection, it's straight to Hollywood for me, you know, and he was using it negatively. But by the time he went there in the late 30s, he was taking it as an artist taking on a new craft, and he really taught himself the craft of screenwriting.
And I guess recognized the importance that cinema would have in popular culture.
I think that, and he needed desperately to get out of debt. I don't think there was a part of him that always felt a little torn because it took him away from writing his fiction quite a bit in those 3 years. So he worked up great material, but he had a hard time getting new material out while he was working full time for Hollywood. So he was torn about it.
It must be an interesting challenge for you as a novelist to have these characters, to have to really embody them and give them a voice, and but not to have created the characters. How did you make decisions about the liberties you could take and the things that you felt had to be sort of documented by historical fact?
Yeah, that's a very interesting point about historical fiction in general. The one thing is I'm very attracted to this scenario, but also novels that would be along the lines of this scenario. J.M. Coetzee, the South African writer, The Master of Petersburg, has this wonderful novel about Dostoevsky going to Petersburg to investigate the death of his stepson related to revolutionary activity at the time. Much of the material in the frame is true, although the stepson actually outlives Dostoevsky, so that part is false. But he basically creates a wrinkle in history, and then he creates the scenario that Dostoevsky steps into. So that's part of what I had here. You described it very nicely in the opening, is there's a frame here, but there's an immense hole. There's an immense gap. And as a fiction writer, you do have a lot of imaginative license there. You have to make certain decisions. When I feature a character named Aurelio, who's a refugee from the Spanish Civil War, I had to make sure that the camp I was describing was extant at the time and that the conditions were roughly such as I described them. So there I'm beholden to history and I want to get it right. I take liberty with Scott's nobody will know this until I say it just now, but Scott is in a cabin with a captain's deck in the opening of the novel. That captain's deck is actually on the cabin that he lived in before the one in Encino. There I thought, I really want this scene of him on the deck looking out into the forest, and I just didn't feel that the architectural question of whether it was the second to last or last place he lived in mattered as much. So where it's history writ large, I felt you really have to abide by certain things and investigate them. And I really worked hard not to have undue anachronisms. But there are other places where you get to take and enjoy the freedom of a writer and an artist.
My guest is author R. Clifton Spargo. His new novel is called Beautiful Fools, The Last Affair of Zelda and Scott Fitzgerald. He's in town to speak this evening at the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. You can find a link to more information about that appearance on the Think page of KERA.org. If you would like to join the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372, and our email address is think@KERA.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author R. Clifton Spargo. His new novel is called Beautiful Fools, The Last Affair of Zelda and Scott Fitzgerald. Clifton is in town to speak this evening at the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. You can learn about that on the Think page of KERA.org. If you'd like to join the conversation, email think at KERA.org or call in to 1-800-933-5372. It's interesting when you are dealing with a character who suffers from mental illness, whose condition sort of has varied a great deal over the years. You have to be aware of that history. I was fascinated that Zelda looks to Scott in this book over and over for confirmation that he thinks that she's getting better.
Right. The mental illness is a loaded topic with Scott and Zelda, and there's a lot that's happened with research about Zelda and to investigate this question. I think my primary way of thinking about that, you do have to do a lot of research, and you have to decide for yourself roughly what you have to know what the diagnosis was, you have to see what the symptoms were, and then you have to decide, mostly as a novelist, how did they understand it themselves? Hmm. And that's the primary thing I tried to. So there are debates now. Some people want to say she should be re-diagnosed retrospectively as bipolar 1 instead of schizophrenic. Or the diagnostic manual right now is actually the symptomology are very close on those two diseases, and she actually did experience most of the things that categorize one as a schizophrenic even today, whether that was a steady experience or not. Well, even today, people go in and out of those episodes. But what was most important to me was how did they negotiate what she had gone through? And her own way of negotiating that was very complex, as it is today for many people who are mentally ill. There will be phases of I'm broken, I can't be fixed, and there will be phases of let me out of here, I'm fine, I don't want any more of this. And Zelda went through that cycle very predictably in her own disease. And one of her gauges for judging her own well-being or illness, even when she was angriest at Scott, so during her first breakdown in Switzerland, the first few months she writes him furious letters. But then there's a point where she just looks this horror, and she's known all along that something's really wrong with her, and she starts asking him for confirmation. You know, who is it can tell me who I am? It's this man I love who has known my past self and who can give me some barometer of whether I can get back there. So that was a real dynamic in the relationship, and it's one I wanted to play up here at a time where I think historically Zelda was recuperating in a way she hadn't for quite some time. The late 30s were probably her healthiest phase of the 30s. She was a tremendously athletic and creative person. And the regime she was put under by Dr. Robert Carroll in her sanitarium in Asheville involved like 5 miles of walking every day, playing volleyball, being outside all the time. And this just answered her soul on some level. So there was a real resilience in Zelda. And she had hit a really low point in the mid-30s, but she was on her way back. And I think she wanted Scott to confirm that, and she was also somewhat lobbying, saying, "I'm getting better, Scott. I want to be able to leave."
She's also, and this is sort of a cruel irony, lucid enough to have recognized that he likes her best, or at least likes himself best as her partner, her spouse, when she is at her worst mentally.
There are several moments where she has these wry remarks in my novel, and she puts these little digs to Scott. I think that historically that's a little bit complicated. I think Scott genuinely was sorrowful that he had lost when Zelda really broke down. He thought that first time she had made a full recovery, when they went back to the States, they were really hopeful that she'd made a full recovery. So I do think there's part of Scott who feels like he never got back his golden girl of the 20s. But there's certainly, if you go back to that paradigm of, as a writer, I'm trying to occupy Zelda's perspective. And at times she must have felt during the 30s that you want to maintain this power over me, because Scott was in denial about his own alcoholism, and that was a constant source of tension between them. So there is a lot of contentious conversation in which she's saying, you're acting as though this wasn't a product of our relationship. You're acting as though it's only my illness, but there's other things going on here. And I think that's true of the historical Zelda, and it's true of the Zelda that I tried to portray. I wanted to bring that quality out in her.
So he's in denial about his own alcoholism, and yet everyone else in his life is in denial about the fact that his tuberculosis is back and in a pretty virulent form.
Yeah, the TB is interesting because people like to call Scott Fitzgerald a hypochondriac, and many of his biographers insist that most of the tubercular worry was a product of hypochondria. His main biographer rebutted that very firmly and showed x-rays in 35, 36 that show the tuberculosis in Scott's lungs. So again, as a novelist, I don't have to absolutely choose there. All I have to decide is Scott believes and is feeling the symptoms of tuberculosis. I actually do think he suffered from tuberculosis, and I know that he believed he had suffered from it for quite some time. So he did. He was treated as a hypochondriac by his biographers, but he's also treated as a hypochondriac by many of his friends. And there was a little bit of that. There's a very famous, the most famous portrait of all of them is in A Movable Feast, where Ernest Hemingway, in his memory of Paris in the 20s, which is hardly generous of most of the people, it's actually most affectionate towards Scott of anybody. Some of the others are just downright nasty, but there's still some nastiness in his portrayal of Scott. And he has a long scene in which Scott, they're supposed to be driving back Scott's car to Paris, and it's they've taken off Zelda, and he have knocked off the convertible top, so they get caught in a downpour, and Scott thinks he's sick, and Hemingway's just ridiculing him and saying, you're not sick, and he's basically, the whole portrait is to show that Scott Fitzgerald was this kind of little bit weak-willed, hypochondriac kind of character, and some of his friends really believe that about him.
Do you think Scott knew he was going to die young?
On his birthday, it's a great irony to be talking about this question. Early on, he wanted to die young. And this does go to some of the hypochondria stuff. So here's two little anecdotes. One is, on his 30th birthday, he rushes into Gertrude Stein's parlor. And this is from Alice B. Toklas remembering this incident. And he says, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? I'm 30. I can't be 30. I can't be a writer who's 30. And presumably this wasn't only his worry about aging. It was also that he was the documentary writer of the Roaring Twenties and this young generation, yeah, and the Flapper Girls and all this stuff. And Gertrude Stein calmly looks at him and says, but Scott, you've been writing like a man of 30 for quite some time, which is kind of a refreshing little note. And she appreciated The Great Gatsby, and her terms for appreciation were being echoed at that moment when she had said, it's a modern orgy of a book. Hadn't been done until you did This Side of Paradise. I thought that book was all right. This book is as good, but older and different. One doesn't get better. One gets older and different. Those were the terms of Stein's praise for The Great Gatsby. So she's saying, why are you worrying? This is a maturation in you that we want in an artist. But Scott was deeply, deeply nervous about aging. And he used to tell his editor and friends that he wanted to die by 30. He wrote to Max Perkins, you can find letters saying, I used to say I wanted to die by 25, now it's 30. So this is somebody who kind of had, he was steeped in the romantic poets, steeped mm-hmm. in folks, Keats, Byron, all of whom die young, and then believed he had succumbed to some tuberculosis early in his life. He's living the alcoholism is very early on, and he himself was conscious. He even makes some association between alcoholism and suicide early in his life. So there is a part of Scott that had that old poetical death wish. And whether that meant At this point, was he aware? I think late in his life, he was aware that he was quite sick. I mean, you have to remember that he's going to have a severe heart attack, recover from that heart attack, and then die of a heart attack all in the upcoming year. And, you know, he has to be institutionalized numerous times for his alcoholism and his tubercular symptoms. So he's really given his body a hard time by this point in his life. So I think there is a part of him that realizes, and even while writing The Last Tycoon, there are several points where he says, if I can just finish this book, that, you know, it will secure my reputation.
So Scott Fitzgerald remained sort of nominally loyal to Zelda, but, you know, had a very serious girlfriend in Los Angeles, and someone that he felt was good for him, was sort of a healthy relationship for him to be in, but he couldn't break from Zelda. He takes her on this trip. I mean, at this point in their lives, would you define what existed between Scott and Zelda as love or as something like an addiction?
I would define it as love. There's a line in the novel in which I say, and Scott himself used the language of duty, and he... duty was the form his love for Zelda had assumed. This loyalty to a woman he'd always loved, the one last truth to which he held firm. I think that is true for Scott, and he was a highly conscientious, dutiful person, and I do think duty is part of the equation of love. I think what happened with Zelda is that early on in the 30s when she broke down, he thought she could get well. I think he held to that belief all the way through the first breakdown, through much of the second breakdown. And there's a famous line in which he says, I lost my capacity for hope on the little road that led to Zelda's asylum. I think that line is basically true. I do think that at a certain point in the mid-30s, he did not think Zelda would ever be her old self again. And that is the point at which he is most depressive. It's the point at which he's most irresponsible. It's the point at which he has the most liaisons. And then he does get one very stable relationship at the end of his life. And Sheila Graham was good for him. I think there's no question about that. Scotty, the daughter of Zelda and Scott, came out and visited and thought well of Sheila Graham. Edmund Wilson and a number of other friends thought this was a woman who was good for Scott, who kept him on the wagon, you know, was not all the time, but most of the time. He was actually sober much of his time in Hollywood. I don't know what percentage, but it was a high percentage. He fell off the wagon a few times. So I think that really he only gave his heart also to somebody else late in the 30s when he did not think Zelda was coming back to him for good or as her old self. But I think even at that moment, he made it a condition of his relationship that he would never divorce. Sheila Graham knew. She had just left. She broke off an engagement to be with Scott, and he made it a condition. He said, I will never divorce Zelda. It's something I cannot do. I'll always be loyal to her. So that was the form his love took. He believed that in her sickness, she could not get her old self all the way back. And I think up until Sheila Graham, most of the other affairs were dalliances of a lonely man. Zelda had a few in her early life as well. But I do think in the end, there are many forms of love. And I think this was a deeply devoted form of love, that in the end, there was a way in which they were a mirror to one another. They were co-collaborators. And I don't think Scott ever was kind of fully imaginatively in the company of anybody again once he lost Zelda.
This novel also made me, in a way that I found appealing, sort of ravenously curious for details about Scotty, who, like Hemingway, is alluded to, but not very much. Right. And I don't know if you have kids, but it's hard for most couples who have children not to talk about them on a regular basis. And I wonder what you think it says about these two individuals that they sort of refer to her once or twice, and then she's not really part of this week they spend together.
Yeah. I should say, first of all, that there are – so in this time, 37 to 39, Scott would take Zelda on vacations. And while he's starting up this relationship with Sheila Graham, he would still go and take her on vacations. A couple of them, Scotty goes with them. So there's a famous one in South Carolina that went very poorly, in which Zelda really acted out. And Scotty's remembrance of it was mostly pinning it, the problem on Zelda in that case. Scott was a very dutiful father, and he was dutiful toward the overbearing side. He would write her notes telling her how to navigate the politics of being a student at Vassar, telling her all the mistakes he'd made in his career at Princeton, that she was repeating some of his same mistakes and not to do this, not to do that. But he really was into Scotty's life imaginatively in a full way as a father. She was often in the care of others, but Scott was very diligent about looking after her. Zelda, for most of Scotty's life, wasn't that capable of doing it, though the summer after this trip, Scotty will have to have an appendectomy, and she'll go down to Asheville to be with Zelda, who will take care of her. So there were still those moments where the motherly care kicks in. In my novel, there's a moment where Scott tries to bring up Scotty while they're walking, and Zelda says, not now, I can't talk about her right now. Because for Zelda, this trip, as I frame it, is about the possibility, the last possibility, as it turns out, of getting Scott back. So Scotty is a topic for another day. The topic for this day or these days, and she doesn't even know how long. In my novel, Zelda doesn't know when the trip will end. That may or may not have been true. I don't know whether they actually had an end date for the trip planned. But she is concentrating on doing everything she can to prove that she's back and she can be a partner to Scott. And so that's why I think Scotty doesn't loom largely at this point for her.
My guest is author R. Clifton Spargo. His novel, Beautiful Fools, The Last Affair of Zelda and Scott Fitzgerald, is out now. He's in town to speak this evening at the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture. You can find more information about that on the Think page of KERA.org. We'll be back in a couple of minutes. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author R. Clifton Spargo, who's in town to speak this evening at the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture, and is the author of the new novel Beautiful Fools, The Last Affair of Zelda and Scott Fitzgerald. If you'd like to be part of the conversation or ask a question, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. It's funny that we haven't talked much about how money problems played into the way they related to one another. Strangely, Scott seems to indulge every whim that he possibly can of Zelda's, and yet he can't help but resent how much she has cost him.
Right. And I think that dynamic was just partly true of their relationship of Scott. Scott was really terrible with money. It's one thing to be terrible with money and to be making a fair amount of it in your 20s. There's no part of me that thinks Zelda and Scott, they live this, it's almost like this allegorical life. She is the age of the century, right? So they are the roaring 20s. And then she breaks down 5 months after the October crash. And, you know, they live their own personal Great Depression. So money was just a huge factor in the relationship. They were in debt very early in the 20s while they were making good money because they were too frivolous. They were living beyond their means. Then when the breakdowns occur, Scott got her the very best care and would spare no expense. It's interesting to note that during her first breakdown in Switzerland, Carl Jung was almost called in as a consultant, but he wasn't expert enough. So they got Ernst Bleuler, who's actually the man who coined the term schizophrenia and the term autism, and was the leading, was the foremost expert on schizophrenia, and he confirmed that diagnosis. So at no point, even though he's digging deeper and deeper into debt, he's borrowing from his agent, his editor, and Scribner's, at no point will he spare any expense when it comes to Zelda. Sometimes those are extravagant things, like she needs a new perfume or something like that. But he thinks this is going to be good for her psyche, for her to have some continuity with her old self. So he tries to get her even that. Sometimes it's just getting her art supplies. And a lot of their correspondence in the 30s does become about practical matters of money. She needs this or that. Besides the bills he's paying at the institution, her personal expenses always have to be paid by Scott. So a lot of it was negotiating money, and it was a big burden on him, and at times he resented it, but there was also a part of him that couldn't but be generous and wanted to give her gifts. The first thing he ever did when he made a big Saturday Evening Post, when he sold his first big Saturday Evening Post story, he went out and bought her this ridiculously expensive platinum watch. It was like 2/3 of his income at the time. I mean, it was a crazy expenditure. So he was always a little bit extravagant when it came to Zelda.
And she takes a dig at him in the novel and says, well, my father said you'd never be able to pay your taxes.
Well, the fact of the matter is that we know, and Scott was a little bit bitter about this his entire life, and he wrote a lot of fiction, including The Great Gatsby, which resonates to this theme, that they had been engaged when she was just 18, and she broke the engagement because he didn't have sufficient means to provide for her. And she said, I can't do that. And he was trying to make it as a writer. He was working in advertising in New York, and he wasn't making any money. And they were engaged, and she was dating half the Auburn football team. And finally, he came down all worried several times, and she finally said, I can't marry you, and gave back the ring. Scott goes back to Minnesota to rewrite the novel that's been rejected a couple times for Scribner's and sells it. And the first thing he says to Max Perkins is, well, how soon can you publish it? Because there's a girl at stake. And then as soon as they confirm that they're going to publish it, he rushes down, proposes to Zelda, and they get married a week after the novel appears.
The other fascinating thing to me about you choosing this last week that they were together is the fact that we as a society are sort of hung up on the young and beautiful Scott and Zelda, right? The jazz right. age Scott and Zelda, when maybe they were burning through way more money than they had, but it just all seemed like a lark. And then there's something about them being like middle-aged and their bodies are changing and they, you know, remember how great it was. They remember how famous they were and they can't quite recapture that magic. It's a much more challenging place to go right. and to hold our attention. And you do it beautifully here, but did you worry about that?
Sure. I worried about that from the standpoint of Zelda. And we had talked during the break about the many faces of Zelda. Mm-hmm. She photographed so diversely that, like, there are famous photo shoots where there's like five different shots of her and they all look like a different woman. But the very sad thing is that the mental illness, one of the major symptoms was eczema over her entire body, and it really wore on her. So she really has this self-consciousness about her when they're taking these trips, about how, you know, glamorous she once was and how that's only a memory at this point in time. But I also thought, you know, Woody Allen's Midnight in Paris, that's the Scott and Zelda we all remember. And they're entertaining. He's a heck of a good writer. She's a heck of a witty conversationalist. They're the life of the party. They were supposedly, no matter how inebriated, they had incredible charisma. But I find the Scott and Zelda of the 30s a little more interesting, in all honesty. It's just life is, for everyone at some point, full of hard knocks. Here comes this couple. For all their youthful extravagance, there's no way you can make me believe that though Scott seemed to believe it at times, that this is the debt you had to pay for partying in the 20s is to sink this low and to suffer this much. But I think they're kind of brave in the face of adversity. I think Zelda is brave in still hoping for a future at all times and trying to get Scott to believe again. And at different times, they would play that role for each other when the other was most down of lifting up the spirits throughout that decade. And so I think this trip probably had some of that. I speculate that he's recently broken up with Sheila Graham, and maybe this was this one last chance for reunion. They don't know it. They don't know that this they're not going to see each other again after this trip. But the idea that after so much has been lost, that you can still hope to recapture. And really, the sad thing is, of course, they are still relatively young.
Yeah.
I mean, she's only on this trip. Has she turned 39 yet? No. So she's still 38 on this trip. They are still so young, but they've lost. And there's a couple of moments. They always, both of them had a habit of using young. Like, you could go to the beach, get tanned, and become young. You know, it's like they had this way that young was a matter of spirit. Zelda wrote once of Scott's The Offshore Pirate, "You were so young then, you were younger than anybody in the world." And it was this kind of undaunted, youthful hope. And so I find to have preserved some of that spirit of hopefulness in the face of reality and true adversity, that Scott and Zelda are more fascinating to me. And frankly, I just find them deeper and more complex, though they're a more challenging couple to try to get a hold on. They're a little bit all over the place at the same time.
So you can look at copies of their diaries, you can look at letters they wrote, but recognizing that people don't necessarily, and even then did not necessarily write exactly as they speak, what cues did you take about phrases to use that informed the dialogue you wrote?
Yeah, that's a tricky thing. I did not side. I think if you're doing something that is historical fiction, some people will try to do dialogue or banter that really sounds period authentic, like to the rhythms and to the artifice. I am of the school that you want some of the jargon. You don't want the jargon to be anachronistic. So, flyboy, if you have an aviator referred to as a flyboy, that's jargon that came about in the 20s. And so there are moments like that through the novel. But I didn't want the rhythms to feel archaic. I wanted them to feel contemporary, but then to have the references to be historically solid. The interesting case, there's an example of Zelda's letter. You have this couple that their lives are so recorded and they saved a lot of their letters, but there's all kinds of things that go missing from our lives. And that's also the way I thought about this novel. It's like if any one of us were to imagine the person sitting across the room, that person's going to become our biographer. All the things that person can never know about us. Mm-hmm. And a novel is an opportunity to think about all of what a biography cannot capture. Scott hated biography, by the way. He said you couldn't write a good biography about writers because writers are too many people. But also because I think it felt too ordered and confining to him. So when I went to something like Zelda's letter, I tried to capture some of the rhythms of her letter writing, but I didn't try to make it exactly approximate to a Zelda letter. So it's a tricky balance. Like, you're trying to get something that would feel like her voice. I wanted the free associative rhythm of her voice, her habit of stringing clauses together, sometimes a little bit non sequitur. I wanted some of those patterns of thought to be reflected in the speech, but I wanted it still to feel like that could be a letter that a woman is writing to her lover in 2013. So it's a delicate balance, but that's the one I was trying to strike.
How well do you think they felt they knew each other, and how aware were they both that there were secrets remaining in their relationship?
Yeah. I would almost say that they fall into the category of people who knew each other too well. I really do think there's a way we sometimes call this codependent. I think that's a little bit of an easy piece of jargon to fall back on. It's more complex than that. Each of them filled a profound need in the other and answered something in the other. But there was so much, and that's why you were talking earlier about the mental illness and Zelda's referring it and looking for confirmation from Scott. Am I getting better? And she knew on certain things that he would never betray her. She's actually the one who made the monogamy. She was the most loose theoretically about monogamy, much more loose. Scott was much more moralistic about that question. But early on, Zelda, even when they're engaged, said, oh, you could go off with someone. And it wouldn't change a thing about how you feel about me or how I feel about you. She was very casual about that in her own attitudes. But they did refer a lot. And there's a point where Scott's writing The Gatsby, and it's actually the first time he almost the entirety of The Beautiful and Damned he read aloud to Zelda as he was writing it. Gatsby was the first book where he stopped that habit. It's actually when she has the famous affair because she's bored. But when it came to the revisions and the rewrites, when he needed to rewrite the character of Gatsby, and Max Perkins says, well, I can't really see this guy. He seems like a much older character than the character I think you want to be writing. He goes to Zelda. Zelda writes, like, draws 20 pictures of Gatsby. They read aloud the book. So they referred so many things to each other that there really was this way in which they knew each other deeply and profoundly. And sometimes, why I say too well, is sometimes when you know the other person's worst traits, when you know the other person's demons and the things that they can't get out of the way of, those stick in your memory. And I play with the fact, biographers speculate, it's clear that Scott gave instructions to his daughter, Scotty, not to tell Zelda about Sheila Graham, mm-hmm. worried, I think, properly and fairly that it might have a negative impact on her psychic well-being. But I have Zelda intuit it and then intuit it through. There's a big fortune teller scene in Cuba where she gets the news that she already knows. And she suspected, there's earlier hints in the novel that she suspected the presence of this other woman in his life. And I think that she would just know that. She didn't have to hear it from anybody. She would just feel it intuitively because she knew Scott so well. She would feel the part of Scott that's just a little bit defensive and closed off. And even if he has recently broken up with Sheila Graham and maybe there's room for her and she feels that there might be room for her at several points in the novel and she's trying to create that space, she would also feel the presence of this other woman because she knew him that well. She might not be bothered by somebody who had been more casual, but with someone who had actually taken a place in his life, I think she sensed that. There are a couple hints after his death that she knew of Sheila, and she wrote a little dismissively of her, seeing her obviously as a rival. But I think they know each other so well that this is something Zelda would have just sniffed out.
I can only give you a one-word answer to this, but even knowing the parameters as you went into this project, was there any part of you that wished that you could have ended it in a different way?
Yes. Yes, this is the one-word answer. And the ending really tries for that. There's a lot. They're really pushing against. I felt that there's at the end, the frame comes back, but they're pushing for that space and they're pushing for a visit to California that could still happen. So they're still striving for that place in the sun, even as the novel ends. And I wanted that note.
The new novel by R. Clifton Spargo is called Beautiful Fools, The Last Affair of Zelda and Scott Fitzgerald. Clifton, it's been wonderful to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Podcast is produced by Christine McConnell. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.